Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Weird Era, a literary podcast where we ask the right questions. I'm joined today by Cameron Russell to discuss her memoir, How to Make Herself Agreeable to Everyone. Cameron Russell has spent the last 20 years working as a model for clients including Prada, Calvin Klein, Victoria's Secret, H&M, Vogue, and Elle. With over 40 million views, her TED Talk on the Power of Image is one of the most popular of all time. She's the co-founder of Model Mafia, a collective of hundreds of fashion models striving for a more equitable, just, and sustainable industry. She continues to organize, consult, and speak to transform extractive supply chains and center climate justice. She lives in New York with her family. Scouted by a modeling agency when she was just 16 years old, Cameron Russell first approached her job with some reservations. She was a serious student with her sights set on college, not the runway. But modeling was a job that seemed to offer young women like herself unprecedented access to wealth, fame, and influence. Besides, as she was often reminded, there are a million girls in line who would eagerly replace her. In her fierce and innovative memoir, Russell chronicles how she learned to navigate the dizzying space between physical appearance and interiority and making money in an often exploitative system. Being agreeable, she found, led to more success, more bookings, and more opportunities to work with the world's top photographers and biggest brands. But as her prominence grew, Russell found that achievement under these conditions was deeply isolating and ultimately unsatisfying. Instead of freedom, she was often required to perform the role of compliant femme fatale. So she began organizing with her peers, helping to coordinate movements for labor rights, climate and racial justice, and bringing Me Too to the fashion industry. Intimate and illuminating, How to Make Herself Agreeable to Everyone is a nuanced, deeply felt memoir about beauty, complicity, and the fight for a better world. Hi, Cameron. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Alex. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start just by acknowledging that this is not a typical model memoir. You've placed yourself among some very celebrated writers by the form you chose to write in, as well as the content that you're sharing. I had mentioned this to you already, but the references you make, the literary ones, the activist ones, contain some pretty deep cuts. I can only assume you're an extremely well-read individual. Here, though, I want to ask, why did you think it was important to include these references and the extensive footnotes throughout this book? And did you have to fight to have them included in the first place?
A great question that if my editor is listening is going to be like, I told you to make them endnotes. And then I was like, I love footnotes. And then they were like, nobody reads footnotes. And I was like, I do. I really love footnotes. I love reading. And I love that when you find a writer who feels like company, they like a good friend, they like introduce you to their friends, you know, like that's how we find like our best friends, our best lovers. It's like someone who's like, oh, you should really know this person. And then you're like, whoa, I really should know this person. So I feel like footnotes are that for me. That's probably a pretty nerdy interpretation of footnotes, but that is how I always feel about them. And after you said that to me at the reading the other night, I was thinking of all the people I left out, of course. And the main person that I just realized, like, I don't think they ended up in a footnote whose essay made me want to write and who made me want to write this book and figure out how to start it, is a writer named Binyavango Wainaina, who's a Kenyan writer who wrote an essay called It's Only a Matter of Acceleration Now that ended up in Chimurenga. And this is a essay written in a list form. And I reread it every couple years, because I don't want to think too hard about why it works so well for me. I just want to be inside this experience. Everything about this piece of writing and Binyavanga as a writer in general is so moving and inspiring to me. And so definitely go look up that essay.
I will. Thank you. Did you think including those references were important to the fact that you were writing, you know, a quote unquote model memoir? Is this you also kind of subverting this genre of book in a way, or maybe I would rather say intellectualizing this type of memoir?
You know, I think there's a lot of precedent for memoir being very useful and powerful, political, intellectual act that really allows us to find knowledge before there are enough like admissible sources to say that this is knowledge, or before our economy or our culture catch up to saying, oh, we care about what that person over there has to say. So, you know, there's lots of words for this. Like, people will call it like auto theory, right? Which is like a sort of feminist, like literary term. Or I think also of like the sort of genre of like lyric essay. And people who are, who inspired me, I think often, you know, there's something about memoir and personal essay that says, of course, we cannot take ourselves out of what we are thinking and what we are learning. Of course, we are present in that. You know, sometimes when I read nonfiction and it reads as if it is the authority on the matter, or, you know, you kind of are reading and you're wondering, well, I wonder why this person was so fascinated by this. That seems like a very important question. And so I like that memoir plus research, right? Plus, like, it says, this is why I'm compelled, and this is why this archive means so much to me.
You make numerous references to Nabokov and his work Lolita throughout the book. Obviously, there are some parallels with her character and yourself as a young woman entering the world of modeling. But as a bookseller, I do love when people pick this text up because it means I can have this conversation with them about reading and about, you know, careful reading and critical analysis. In that same breath then, and now I'm thinking about this through the lens of modeling and fashion photography, I'm wondering, how do you feel about the concept of separating the art from the artist?
Oh, I think that's so goofy. Please. I think of Woody Allen, people are always like, Woody Allen, separate the art from the artist. And I'm like, but the art is not, like, the content of the art is also bad. Like, that matters. It matters. Maybe it's a nice shot. I don't know. It's cute editing, whatever. He did something avant-garde. But also, like, a lot of the art is bad. Like, that's okay. We can say that. So Nabokov also I put with, like, you know, a whole bunch of people that I was reading as a young teenager, like a 14, 15-year-old, Bukowski, Nabokov, Coetzee, Updike. And those were, like, the accessible literary heroes. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That was just what was in the water. And I put them in because I wanted to kind of ground and, like, right, that's where my cultural upbringing was. And it's so patriarchal in so many ways. And also, there's lots of talent there. And also, it's so patriarchal. And we don't have to separate those. We can talk about them both concurrently. Everybody is complex. So then that really allows me to speak of footnotes, you know, to like talk about when I started to find writers who felt like company in a different way. And I write in the book about reading those books as a young person, thinking, I guess I'm going to read about these to find out what grown men are thinking, because I'm not sure. I did not read those books to figure out about young women. I didn't read Lolita to be like, I wonder what Lolita was thinking. You don't, that's not why you would read that book. You would read the book to be like, what was that grown man thinking? At least for me. So when I started to find books that felt like company in a different way, that was when I started to be more interested in writing and just also felt like, as a human in the world, so much less alone. I mean, I think one that's like pretty universal, but of course is always worth mentioning, is Audre Lorde in reading The Power of the Erotic, just as like the most brilliant capitalist critique ever. That, you know, it's more than just like a critique of an economic system. It's like, but in an embodied way, is this where we want to be? And where mm-hmm. could we be? And a lot of those writers that felt like company, I also thought just were writing in a way that combined all these things that as a human makes so much sense to combine, but because of where I was raised and the education that I received, often I was told were separate. So I think of mm-hmm. Gloria Anzaldúa and The Importance of Dreams. The writer that I do mention in the book that I kept next to my bed while I started writing, Michelle Cliff, who wrote Notes on Speechlessness, and all these writers that, you know, just were some of the most powerful historical education, political education, and then like company, because their work is really caring. You know, their work is really thinking about how can I transmit important care as far mm. as words will let me do it. And also just numbering and lists, that was a revelation to me. I think maybe coming out of like I don't know, like a undergraduate program where I tried to write a thesis and people spent way too much time talking about the 5-paragraph essay. And like, there's something about like lists. I basically start all writing with lists, and then like I sometimes remove the list or sometimes I leave it. And I think it's mm-hmm. because numbers can do the work of cohesion and ordering and momentum, and they take that burden off the words. And so for me, I felt like, okay, this is a way that I can stop performing and be with the language as intimately as possible. So a lot of those writers use lists in a pretty beautiful way, Michelle Cliff in particular.
So you talk about and have many, many excellent criticisms of capitalism throughout this text. There is one that I wanted to highlight when you rent a house after a job in LA. You write, quote, "I cancel jobs. I stay for 2 weeks by myself. Turning down work to choose writing makes me feel like I have to disprove or dismantle capitalism. Otherwise, what am I doing?" This is the crux of the whole book, I think, is you grappling with your own life and how it relates to these massive, you know, global infrastructures that I think we're kind of collectively coming to terms with, in that they're not really sustainable or helping anybody. I want to ask you, how does personal guilt hinder these processes?
You know, I think in that moment, I don't know that I felt necessarily guilty, although maybe a similar word with a slightly different meaning that I think is important is shame. I listened to some interview with a memoirist who said, "Oh, I write because I don't feel ashamed. I feel shameless." And I feel like, oh, my book and my writing and my understanding of the world is often filled with shame. And I find that to be a useful emotion. It helps us identify, you know, our own, not just sort of knowledge of what's happening, but our own place in it, our own, you know, what should I really be doing now? What action am I called to? What responsibility do I have? And am I not taking that responsibility seriously? So I do feel like shame is in the book. And in that particular moment, you know, it was early in writing, and I was working 250, 60 days a year and then travel. And I felt like I just was saying yes to everything because I was successful and I was a freelancer, and that's how it works. And you just keep on going mm-hmm. and saying yes. And when I stopped to try to think clearly, I remember the first part of those 2 weeks, I felt like I was writing like a economics thesis. Like I was so distracted by the very decision to turn down paid work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fashion and my job and the very unique position I had in that world meant that a lot of questions that I think sometimes we say hypothetically felt very, very tangible. Like, what would you do for $1 million? You know, that question is at the end of the book. I don't end up getting that job, but I think that question was pretty clearly posed to me. Or, you know, calculating, like I'm turning down this work, and then I'm reading about campaign finance from prisons, you know, from the prison industrial complex, and how much money are they funneling? And I'm doing the math and I'm like, it's not even that much money. Or how much money is Joe Manchin being paid to, you know, support oil? Like, it's not that much. It doesn't make sense that you would make such terrible decisions for not this much money. And so, you know, then you start to think, okay, so should I make the money and then try to funnel it and use power the same way that these people are using power? And I think the answer is no. Probably that is not the right way to go. But it's really hard to see in how our world is structured, you know, what am I supposed to do if this is how the system mostly appears to be working? Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to make a different choice, then do I need to understand an alternative system and be able to argue for it in full? And that was sort of the like moment that I was in when I wrote that. Like, do I have to dismantle capitalism and say that there is this alternative over here? And luckily, you know, in the intervening years, I think a lot of people have really been trying to answer that question. And we can look at structures like mutual aid that happened during COVID, right? Which really showed pretty profoundly, wow, we can do this on a large scale when the government fails. So I think there are answers that look like yes, more clearly than they did even when I wrote that sentence.
Pivoting just for a minute, how did you feel and did you see the solar eclipse this week? I kind of want to hear about your thoughts or your experience with it, if you care.
Loved the solar eclipse. Watched it with my two younger children, who are 2 and 6. And outside, we didn't get very far. I had tried to figure out, like, where would be the most ideal spot for us to experience this, and with what snacks and what music and what vibe. But actually, it turned out that we were just going to be across the street at the playground and field, because that's where all the kids went after school. So we were there, and someone from the school had had organized an eclipse playlist that included Here Comes the Sun, and, you know, various eclipse children's appropriate music. And, you know, I thought it was just delightful to see through the eyes of a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, because they always just do a brilliant job of being in completely present in wonder. And they just always, you know, remind me to live that way. There's a June Jordan quote where she says, there's no one more serious than children, because there is no one as present in the current moment as children are. And I find that to be very true. So we, for, you know, the entire time, were in the playground watching, and my 6-year-old would be tugging on my sleeve telling me, look now, look now. And then we got home and he drew like a lot of eclipse fan art with different stages of the moon and the sun labeled by number, and then with a character who's iconic in our family that our 13-year-old made up, named Super Kitty. And so then Super Kitty was watching the eclipse and then in a speech bubble just saying, wow. So we spent the entire day in eclipse heaven. How about you? Where did you watch it?
Oh, I watched it on a friend's rooftop in the city. So we kind of got this whole view of Montreal and the mountain and the city also. And I think I also just kind of wanted to ask that, because it really was collectively interesting, I think. It's not every day that you're experiencing something with millions and millions of people. And, you know, like, one of the coolest things was when it happened, when the moment of totality happened, you could hear people cheering and people clapping kind of from all over the city and from all different corners. I've just been really interested now, you know, on these collective experiences and things like that, that aren't joyful. I think we often are dealing with, especially these days, you know, these collective experiences that are kind of more traumatic than anything else. So to have one that was joyful, was really cool. And I liked that, you know, you had the experience of seeing it through your children's eyes. Like, that's interesting to me. It was beautiful. It was a nice day.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that interpretation. And there wasn't, you know, there was like no commercial element. We weren't having to like put our feelings around like World Cup to the side as we like, you know, all engaged. It was just celestial bodies that turns out we're already in space. Didn't have to get on a rocket ship. We're just all floating around in awe.
Nobody plastered any billboards on the solar eclipse, which I'm grateful for.
Thank goodness.
Getting back into it, there's a quote I want to highlight from the chapter, You're a Gemini. The quote is, I think it's not about getting a shot right because the ones from yesterday look good. It's about being the right girl, the girl they want. It's about letting them be in charge, letting them think they made you. There's this concept being discussed these days heavily, the born sexy yesterday trope, which has, you know, really been around since Ovid and Metamorphosis, but is being explored most recently, I would say, in the movie Poor Things. The question being, is modeling to experience being constantly born sexy yesterday?
Okay, I've never heard of that trope until right now. Clearly not on the right part of the internet.
Well, and again, like I was having this discussion with one of my colleagues the other day. She brought it up and we were just like, oh my God, you can filter so many things through this trope and through this idea of men creating, you know, baby sexy women. But that quote specifically from that chapter really reminded me of born sexy yesterday. I think the question is, and maybe not, you know, so much today and what modeling is today or what modeling is for you today. But I'd just like to hear you kind of talk about that concept through that lens.
Yeah, I guess when I hear you read that quote now, I think about this effort that actually, there's a book of about photography out right now called Collaboration. It has many, many co-authors. One who's in the book is a sort of visual theorist, Ariella Aisha Azoulay. And in that book, they are really talking about how photographs are collaborations. Instead of saying subject, they say photograph person. And I try to do that in a couple different chapters in the book and talk about the ways in which we are and are not collaborators when we're in front of the camera, and even the way in which the audience is and is not a collaborator. And I think of when Instagram first started and like many naive people, I was like, oh, it'll be so interesting to see what young women and young femmes do when they are in charge of what ends up inside the frame, when they're the photographer, when they're the editor. And it turned out, you know, for the most part, I think we replicate the male gaze because that is what gets likes and that is what's popular. And that's what our, you know, by and large, our cultural, you know, sensitivity is attuned to celebrate. So I guess it's not, in some ways, it shouldn't be shocking that that's what happened. But then in other pockets, we saw other things happen. And so we can hold on to that, like, sliver. But yeah, I think my experience of making fashion photographs, for the most part, in the first decade of my career, was feeling very much like, in order to work, to continue to work, to be rehired, I felt like I had to play along with this idea of you are you, the photographer. The photographer is the author. And the photographer is making me or making what is most valuable about me. And I whether or not I come with anything else, I'm not supposed to say that I do. You know, when a model is doing well, people will be like, oh, wow, they really have like a certain je ne sais quoi. Like it's supposed to be something that just comes from within inside you. And even the title, you know, how to make yourself agreeable to everyone, I think plays a little bit with that, because that agreeability is, you know, feminine labor that's often seen as something that is just who you are, not what you do. But of course, to make yourself agreeable is exhausting and is skilled labor. And I wanted to identify it as skilled labor. That's a quote from Cassius Dio describing Cleopatra as sort of one of the oldest, right, types of feminine labor. And to say, if we name this skill, if we name the skill of actually collaboration where, you know, the person you're collaborating with doesn't always think that they are in collaboration, if we understand that we're doing that, can we then withhold it? Or can we then actually say it is useful? It's not useful when it's just an expectation. And if you don't fulfill the expectation, then goodbye. We're no longer in a conversation. But it is useful to know how to collaborate. It's useful to know how to be part of someone else's vision. And so I wanted to kind of reclaim some of those skills, but also be able to identify the moments where they were negative. And I think that's kind of the slippery complexity inside this book, is to say, like, when is that porous boundary between us serving our relationships and building a more caring, joyful world? And when is it undermining that? And it's complicated. I think even, you know, the question at the heart of this book also around like tolerance, which I think is a better word than consent, and is a better word than complicity. You know, that, you know, there's a quote that comes to mind from Fred Moten, who's quoting Edouard Glissant, who says, consent not to be a single being. So how is that concept so slippery when we're porous, when we aren't single beings? So I think about that in terms of the camera and just trying to like be cognizant that that is a co-creation, that's a collaboration. I mean, the other way that I think about it, just to like universalize it for a second, and to go back to Instagram, right, is this job that I had like 20 years ago that was so weird, you know, the idea that you would find like your face and body could be commodified, that is actually like pretty universal because of social media. So now we all are in this conversation. And I think one of the things I hope we think about in the book and people take away is like, what responsibility does the audience have to be in collaboration? And this platform, this Instagram platform, you know, which then spawned all these other, you know, visual social media platforms, it was born out of hot or not, right? That was the first question Facebook was designed to ask. So now we see people, you know, using it to fight for their survival, or, you know, to just make a case for a liberation and for, you know, to use it as a tool to educate and to survive. And yet that is the original architecture. And so if we don't forget that, and then we think about what role do we have as an audience to, you know, not just bear witness, but have responsibility. And be in collaboration with people inside the frame.
I was having a conversation with some friends the other day, and we were kind of talking about the concept of people never truly knowing one another. You know, just our minds are so complex and private, it's impossible to know somebody as intimately as we think we can. I wanted to ask how you feel about this through this kind of lens of celebrity culture. You know, yours is a face that can be and has been plastered on a billboard. But do people expect to know you, or is that the safety net of modeling, that it's up to you when people can have access to your mind?
Yeah, I thought a lot about intimacy in this book and how intimate we are or aren't with the audience. You know, even this idea of like Instagram, right? That it's like fake, it's fake intimacy, but it's also mm-hmm. so real because people are pausing their very real lives to take photographs and share them. You know, they're pausing in the moment when their child is born. They're pausing in a moment of like their deepest grief. They're in their very real lives sharing those very real intimate moments. And so ultimately it's impossible to keep those things separate, right? You can't be separate from your human self when you give your time and attention to something. You know, maybe the kind of like, to go back to your original question, I also was just thinking when I heard you say it, like, but can we ever really know ourselves? No, I don't think we can. We can try, but then we keep changing. So there's also that like unlimited mystery of life that we can, you know, is maybe the escape hatch.
Do you have a connection to Montreal? Well, I know your trip here was brief, maybe the other week, but I always ask people about New York. I tend to talk to a lot of New Yorkers, and I talk about New York. And today I wanted to talk about Montreal greedily. What do you love about
it? I love Montreal. Okay, Montreal is so great. My aunt lives there. During the pandemic, wondering what to do with our kids, we realized that we could drive them to Montreal. And what I loved about Montreal, and then we had to keep coming back, is there are so many public activities in the winter for many different ages. And I have felt often in New York, like, what is a intergenerational activity that can be done in the cold in this city? And really, like, one of the only answers is the public library, which is a great answer. Eric Adams is doing his most to like defund them. But in Montreal, there is ice skating, there is sledding, there was an igloo fest, there is all this public art, there's like parks everywhere. And it just felt, and then in the summer, there's like biking everywhere. So it felt like a city that was built to be, or is, you know, being built and being built thoughtfully to be accessible and playful for a lot of different people. And also, unlike so many, maybe this is also like a thing happening within the United States, but it feels like a city that has been able to support, sustain lots of small business, and you know, it just a feeling of lots of neighborhoods where people are. You know, this is like, I'm clearly like, you know, from the United States, like idealizing everything that I saw, but it feels like people are thriving and getting to live a life of some more determination. You know, like landing at your bookstore with all the incredible programming that you're doing. I mean, I'm sure starting a bookstore is actually really, really difficult. But from the outside, I'm like, this is so beautiful. It looks amazing. Great. Chill. Maybe you're up all night trying to make that happen. But it has really, really wonderful feeling that arts and culture is supported. And there is enough breathing room to be able to do that. I also, my friend took me to Mektaba bookstore. And felt similar, you know, like that it had a living room space where people were taking their shoes off. And, you know, just visiting both those in the span of like 48 hours felt like, wow, this city is able to support these spaces that are so necessary and can feel really, I think, pushed out of a lot of American cities.
Well, I mean, and I would also argue that it's very... we have a very intense work-life balance here. The work week is a 35-hour work week in most cases. And I do remember, you know, going to New York on my last trip, I was there with a friend for 5 days, I think. And we kept joking that that was our 6 month stint in New York. Like, it was just, we're 5 days, but it's endless. It's you. Yeah. I'm not even living there. And I felt like I had to grind. And that kind of concept just doesn't really exist as heavily here.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that in New York pretty hardcore, you know, even when you're socializing, there's often this feeling of like socializing, but can we collaborate? Can we work together? Mm. Are we building our networks so that we can do this next thing? Can you show up to this next? And it's not to disparage that anyone who is doing that, because it is a hustle that is required to make it there. To survive, to be an artist is like this constant hustle. And I think you're right to identify Montreal is a little bit more relaxed, like having a little bit more breathing room. And we really, man, we need that to be able to figure out where we go next. We have to be able to breathe and think and, and like sink into all the things that our economy does not prioritize, which is like building relationships, you know, rest, learning, creativity, curiosity. If everything is on the clock, there just isn't enough room for those things that are so necessary.
So last question for you today. You say at one point near the end of the book, I wanted to share more happy stories in this book, more stories about the people I love. Why didn't you? And will you ever share those stories?
Yeah, I think when I got to the end of the book, maybe this is everybody making art. I was like, well, I could have done that better. and I write pretty transparently about being very conscious of how an audience might receive this and what type of stories might engage that audience, that stories of harm, of stories of like victimization, stories that are critical, just felt more poetic and engaging. When I wrote down the other stories, I felt like, oh, is it that I don't know how to write this story? Or is it that we don't know how to receive this story? And so I did feel like as a writer, I was maturing in the process of writing it. And the book that I want to write next would be, I think, regardless of wherever the subject goes, I want to write a book that is thinking about how do we make art that is caring for people. You know, this book, How to Make Herself Agreeable to Everyone, happens kind of in two halves. And in the first half, it is this more traditional memoir, linear narrative that is more about me, just like a single hero's journey. And it is more about harm and more about violence. And the second half really is sort of like grappling with like, why did I write the first half like that? And how can I write it better? And then I got to the end of that and I was like, also, I could have written the second half better. So that, I guess that's what that sentence means to me now. I don't know. thank you so much for this really wonderful, weird conversation and letting me ramble and go all over the place. It was a delight.
Thank you, Cameron.